So now my first guest this evening is Vaughan Winiata. And Vaughan, of course, I want to talk to him about the current affairs. And I'm just so interested in listening to him, well, you know, getting his take on what we might have in front of us as a country, as a whole, because you've got three political parties who, a couple of them, two of them said they'd never work with New Zealand First. And of course, you know, but when you want to get into power, then you get into bed with the people that you used to dislike beforehand. But is it going to work? Is it going to stay the distance? Who knows? So welcome to Radio Wātea this evening, Vaughan Winiata. Nice to have you on board this evening with us at Radio Wātea, Vaughan.
Hey, kia ora, Mary Pika, and it's always great to catch up with you. Man, aren't we in interesting times? It's been fascinating listening to you this evening. Plenty to talk about, that's for sure.
Well, there is plenty to talk about because, you know, I was listening today and I managed to catch a little bit of the swearing-in ceremony. Interesting that, who was it, that Shane and also Tamapotaka, they did their oath in Māori, but none of the other seven or eight Māori did. But that doesn't matter. That's not a prerequisite. But what I thought, look, if I can tell you, but Vaughan, what I thought is it's good enough to roll us out, Māori out, for those things, to stage that sort of public presentation that all is well in Aotearoa. But when you want to normalise the use of Māori, within government organisations, etc., and on a small scale, it's just they want to actually tip them out. Oh, well, I don't know. What do you think about that nonsense?
Yeah, no, I've got very firm views on that. You know, I think it's about time we drew the line in the sand about how our culture just gets used when it's convenient, like a processionary event. And quite frankly, if this bunch were turning up to my marae, I wouldn't be putting any porphyry on for them. They can just go and get their own bloody packet of biscuits and have their own cup of tea. I think if we look at the silver lining in this quite dark cloud that's coming across Māori, we always knew the pendulum was going to swing back hard if there was going to be a change in government. But, we're here now and we're going to deal with it. But I think the positive silver lining is this will unite Māori, not for the right reasons, but not, you know, what we'd wanted. But I can see a real weaving together of Māori who prepared to stand together on this. And it's going to end up in the streets. However, in my heart, I don't think it'll get there, but we can't be complacent. You know, we just cannot afford to sort of assume we've got to have we've got to put our tin hats on and go over the trenches. You know, it's going to be a real tough few years for us.
Well, I do agree with you, and I think that there will be, people will be taking to the streets and there will be protests, and the reason for that is very clear. We've come too far, absolutely. I mean, in the last 40 years, really, and the fact that, and everything that we have gained has been hard won. Well, nothing has ever been given to Māori, nothing at all. When we wanted our own kōhangarau, our kura kaupapa, our irirangi radio, you know, when we wanted all of that, and whakaata Māori, that was hard won. And so, you know, just the sharing, the opportunity for Pākehā and particularly the Crown and government agencies and Pākehā in general to share a little bit of the leadership of this country with Māori, that has been so confronting for Pākehā that they had to vote against. They had to vote for the parties that saw this as not being good for Aotearoa. They didn't have the gumption themselves to say, no, this is not what we want. And so they've fallen into line. So we've got a government now that really wants to put us back into our box and pat us on the heads and say, know thy place. And so we do have to do something. We do.
Yeah, and, you know, it's saddening that, that redneck underbelly that's always existed in New Zealand society is really showing that it's alive and well, and in some ways we haven't come as far as we would have liked to have in the last 183 years. However, the spotlight is really going to go on the Māori MPs across all of the three parties in the coalition, and we're probably going to see that the days of trading as a part-time Māori and taking the good stuff and not dealing with the tough stuff, which is right now. For example, I just can't see how Many marae will be welcoming Winston and Shane. They'll be wanting to have a damn decent chat outside first. And so things, the dynamics have changed. And good on us, you know. And I'm really looking forward. Once all this processionary rubbish that we've had to sort of put up with since the signing and that, because, you know, the real deal is they're going to have to get on with what they promised. To get on with, and we had that rubbish last week in terms of funding tax cuts by encouraging our kids to smoke more. You know, what sort of crap is going on? I think that as, you know, to be frank, as shit gets real, as they have to get to their desks and do what they said they were going to do and get our country apparently back on track, that's their track, you know, that's when we'll find whether they have got what it takes and they're going to be really challenged. What I will say, though, is that opposition parties, you know, Te Pāti Māori will come out swinging, as you know, they will, and they'll do really, really well. But the opposition need to be really united and on the same page in terms of targeting the coalition around the stuff that they really want to contest. And this referendum, man, yeah, it's a sort of almost a take up arms moment. You know, I'm not going to tolerate it. It's just not going to happen on my watch, that's for sure.
No. And I think you're quite right.
The same way, but, yeah. And how does that look, you know, when we get to that day?
And I'll tell you the other thing also is that, you know, it will be particularly our Kohanga Reo movement who will demand, actually, that if you are Māori in a leadership position, then know your role. And at this time, with what's staring us in the face, when we see that our Māori Health Authority will disappear, when we see that the ratepayers will again be able to have a referendum and maybe decide that they're not going to have the local Māori wards. And we know how difficult it was to get those Māori wards anyway. Government departments, we've already said, you know, just that, you know, just the names and the use of te reo, all of the, and lots more. And of course the smoking one, which I was absolutely appalled about. I mean, we know that smoking's a killer, for goodness sake. But all of those sort of things, and it'll be, I believe, that if we've got Māori leadership that is older, sitting in significant positions that are going to be wishy-washy about standing up now and standing up and speaking up, then it'll be our young people that will put the spotlight on the issues. But more importantly, they will turn, I believe, and say to the Māori leadership, which is older, of course, in most instances, and say to them, now this is your time. Either do your job or step aside.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned before about those in terms of Māori, this is our time to step up and truly, you know, find what we stand for. And I think in our very, very large bureaucracy in New Zealand, we have a lot of brown bureaucrats who seem to have sat on their tongues because they don't want to affect their income. And I'm talking about businesses that might be taking government funding or people in highly paid employed roles. You know, to me, there's shades of cowardice in that. I really believe that if you are staying silent because you are worried about biting the hand that feeds, well, that's just a glorified slave.
Mm. Well, it really is, and you know, and then I look at it. I look at the people that have been trying, you know, to introduce. I mean, we've got now our New Zealand history in the school curriculum. It would not surprise me if that's turfed out soon. You know, it wouldn't surprise me if that's not on the agenda to be jettisoned. And so it means that the majority of the population, because the treaty referendum, and although the government has said, no, we will allow it to go to a first reading. Well, a first reading, as you and I know, Vaughan, means that actually then there will be submissions called, and we'll get thousands of the rednecks who will write in and say blah, blah, and they know bugger all about the treaty. I mean, you know, and I'm talking really about the baby boomer and younger, but certainly the baby boomers. They weren't taught anything. They don't want to know anything. And they're the ones that are going to say, oh, we want to say in redefining what the treaty might look like in the future and the principles that we should perhaps be developing. I mean, who actually thinks about, you know, having a crack at rewriting a founding document of any country? You know, and this is what it'll lead to, I believe.
Yeah, and you know, in terms of the, you know, our, the Te Tiriti being a true Tonga and our founding document, it's hilarious that that Boomer brigade, most of them couldn't even articulate back to you any of the articles of Te Tiriti, let alone having read them before. So they're actually, prepared to go in and have a comment on something they do not understand or know anything about. It's hilarious. To me, I find that what the challenge that's been put to Te Tiriti, imagine if you knocked on the door of the Catholic Church and said, look, we've read this thing called the Bible. We're not that fussed with it. We want to rewrite it. What sort of reception you'd get. And that's, I see it in that level. It's like, how dare you go and put your filthy, dirty little fingerprints over the founding document of our country where our ancestors were there and signed, and we are treaty partners, and we got snot bags coming along and running right over referendum. And I'll just probably, just to finish that bit off, Minipeka, why would you trust the descendants of the people that breached the original to rewrite a new copy? It's like, seriously.
Yeah. Well, that's right, because they are the descendants.
You get wound up about this.
Look, Avon, you're so right. They are the descendants of the colonizers. So that's certainly, and they have not. And all the years that they've been growing up here and actually living off the assets that were taken, and particularly the natural assets that were taken from Māori in terms of land and everything else like that. But they've never, ever felt inclined to say, well, let's have a look and see, let's have a look at the treaty. If it was a document that was meant to be honoured and honourable action should be taken, have we fallen down? Well, hell yes, they have. But very few of them have been absolutely even interested, because they're not interested. Unfortunately for them, the chickens are coming home to roost.
The chickens are coming home to roost. And I see a sort of hekoi proportions. I see something that will stop the country, in terms of where, if this gets past the first reading and we get the point that, hey, this is looking like it's a way bigger threat and has the reality of coming to fruition, I do believe that out on the streets there will be disruption. I don't think blood will be spilt, but, you know, the modern protester is not really a violent protester. That they're a lot more savvy than that. But I've thought about it and thought, gee, what does objecting to this look like? If we think, you know, it'll make the Springbok Tour of 81 just look like child's play. That's nothing like what would go on this time round, because you touched on it before. There's a younger generation coming through, and not all Māori, by the way, just well-educated, informed people that will look at this and go, hey, we're not going to give the boomers what they want. I mean, you know, it's time for them to just move on. Thank you very much. Well, I'm a boomer. And it's like I'm glad to see the energy that's coming through. And this is what the beautiful thing about the current iteration of Te Pāti Māori is, man, the energy in there is fearless, you know, that's what we're going to have to be.
Well, I think, you know, when you look at the Māori members of parliament, and then when you look at the Māori who are in the opposition with on the Labour government, and then, of course, Marama Davidson and there's others in the Greens party. So you've got, probably 15 Māori in opposition. That will be in terms of the Labour, Greens, and Māori Party. So if there's at least 15 of them, and they absolutely know the treaty back the front, backwards and frontwards, they know what the social issues are, they know the history of Aotearoa, and so I believe that they will make life shocking, and they will show up they will make life so difficult for the government when they're debating anything on the floor of the House, because if you don't know this stuff, and if you get the opposition going at them one after the other, and knowing what the issues are, knowing the impacts, knowing the history, then the government will look so, the coalition government not only will look so foolish, then they will not get the cooperation, I suspect, even, believe it or not, from the government agencies that they want, that they need, actually, that they need to implement their policy. Now, how would that be?
Yeah, and that's what you've just touched on there that I think is going to be exposed if this really gets to a decent debate is how much the coalition do not know about our history and Te Tiriti. The fact is that the coalition across the three parties, they don't actually believe that we are treaty partners. That's a fundamental issue that we've got there. And, you know, they look in the mirror and, well, you've got politicians by and large are intoxicated by power. That is their methamphetamine. And that's what we're seeing right now is that what's going through the minds of the key people signing those documents down there in Wellington are the baubles of power. It's not what's good for the people or whatever. Well, that'll all just, that haze will phase away and we'll get down and go, hey, we've got 3 years of this. Are they going to completely surprise us and get some good runs on the boards in other areas? I'm not going to hold my breath for that. But right now, for me, the fundamental issue is that referendum is, it's just non-negotiable. And this could ruin their three-year term. To me, it is a real turd in the punch bowl. I just can't believe that they let it see the light of day. And you know what? I guess what you've got to say is, geez, that Seymour fella must be a good salesman to get it over the line with Luxon and Peters. It's going to be interesting times. But it's more than that. It's going to be times where we are going to have to mobilise.
Exactly.
And, you know, we just can't. You and I, and many of us, can have great kōrero about this, but what does that look like in action? That's what we've got to start talking about. There has to be a resistance against this. And it might sound a bit militant, but hey, I'm not taking any. You know, we're not going to take this line down. That's no. For sure.
That's true. Now, listen, I just see we're in Auckland, because you live in Auckland, I see where it looks as if you might be facing some significant rate rises in the coming years, because in the budget that Mayor Brown is proposing, he's just saying that, the council is, there's obviously significant funding that's required, jobs are going to go. And they're going to, and they want to work on the infrastructure, of course, and we can understand that. And they're pulling the funds from the earthquake strengthening projects. But it looks as if Auckland could see some significant rate rises because of, in the past, apparently, all this deferring of repairs and maintenance to the significant infrastructure of Auckland.
Well, I think in terms of Brown being the one, you know, because he's an interesting character as our mayor, but Brown being the one that's, publishing the news or at least making the announcements that the rate rises are going, and look, they have to happen. You know, we're not exactly broke as a city, but we've got a lot of repairs and maintenance that we need to do if we want to call ourselves a going concern as far as cities go. You know, my analogy of Wayne Brown is that deferment is a fantastic word. We're probably talking three decades of putting off, basic work that needs to be done. He's literally walked in there, you know, lifted up the lid, and he's got a splattered bowl he's staring at. It's, the city's a mess, and there's no other way around it. You know, it has to be funded. And so property owners in Auckland, are going to need to budget for not just an increase, but successive increases over the next decades.
And I know what he's, you know, when he says, apparently he's been quoted as saying that the chickens have come home to roost. And to a certain extent, I actually agree with him, because I was 11 years a councillor here in Rotorua on the Rotorua Lakes Council. And every time, every year, when you were looking at setting the rates, particularly the older people on a fixed income who own their own homes, and they wanted the rates kept as low as possible. And of course, the councillors buckle. They buckle to that all the time. And so the significant infrastructure, which is basically your three waters, your storm water, your wastewater, and your drinking water, your pipes, and then, of course, the roading that the councils are responsible for, that was deferred. The maintenance, repairs and maintenance was deferred, was pushed out. And then, of course, we didn't increase our infrastructure and grow our infrastructure, increase the infrastructure for the growth of the city. And so, of course, when you defer like that, At some stage, it has got to come home. But the ratepayers insisted, no, 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 we don't want to see it go. Well, I can tell you what, we should have. Or I always say, this was my belief. I always say to the rate, this is what I believe. I said, the ratepayers should anticipate a 10% increase in rates per year, and then the council can work to pare it back. To pair it back to perhaps 6.5 or 7.5. But yeah, only every householder who owns their own home would say, okay, I'd have to realize that because of the repairs, because, you know, every city, they want, when they get up in the morning, they want to flush their loo, they want to turn the lights on, they want to go to the library, they want to have good sports fields, all of those sort of things. They want the, you know, the lights in the city to go on and everything else. They want the dog compound to be okay. All of those things that make that make a city run smoothly. And yet, when the regulations change, when perhaps the standards for drinking water are raised, then you've got to do an additional, all of this sort of thing, you know, you've got to have additional outlay, then someone's got to pay for it. The ratepayers have to pay for it. So, you know, I just feel the ratepayers themselves, they'd have bought it on themselves. They should have allowed for additional rate increases every year.
Yeah, that's right. I think if you are going to buy a property, you have to budget in the ownership of that property, that rate increases are just a fact of life. But I think that, you know, if you compare central elections, like our general election, for central government, which we've just had, and local body, which we had last year, local body, they get into power by promising bugger all in terms of rate rises, and government gets in by promising tax cuts, as we've seen, and that's blown up in Nicola Willis's face in the first week. And then on the other side, what I do look at in Auckland is that the cost of doing anything has gone through the roof. So the bang for buck for the ratepayer dollar, the revenue you get in out of ratepayers, you don't get the roads and tunnels and bridges that you used to get. My God, in Auckland, before you do anything, they're going to put out 200 road cones and have traffic, you know, stoplights and all sorts of stuff before, that's a week before they do the work. You know, the health and safety and all that. It's a whole different ballgame just getting anything done now. And so the dollars just get sucked up. And, I just fell off my chair when I saw that Auckland Council spends $500 million a year on traffic management, red cones. You know, it's just ridiculous. Yeah. Sort of thing. I know you've got to have them, but sheesh. So sadly, if you're in Auckland City and you own a property, you're going to have to dig deep into your pockets. And I think people will change their view in terms of how they own their property. You know, smaller footprints, apartments and stuff like that is definitely going to come. But in the short term, that's not going to save those people that are here.
No. Well, you're right. The one thing that I've always wondered about is because, as you know, the rate take, the GST on the rate take for every council in the country, that heads to Wellington, and I've always thought, particularly as we know that most councils, that's why they've got to put up their rates to the extent of usually 10% plus, particularly in recent years, just to try to keep up with the infrastructure costs and other significant capital projects. But I've always thought that why couldn't the GST take from the rates, why couldn't that be ring-fenced for infrastructure? And what the government could say, what they could say to them, we're going to give you 12 years. We're going to give you three terms. The GST that you take from the rates, you can retain that, and we'll want to see where you want to spend it. So we'll want a comprehensive infrastructure plan developed so that over the next year, next 10 years or 12 years, we will know what it's spent on, and then we'll know we're getting value for money. And then after that, most councils, after 12 years, should be in a position where they've got good infrastructure, and through the normal rate take, they should be able to maintain their infrastructure, repairs and maintenance, and for growth. But, you know, I can't believe it, but local government and councils have never lobbied sufficiently hard enough to say to the council, leave our GST component of the rate take.
Yeah, and look, that's one thing in terms of what I will give Wayne Brown is he's the first mayor I've been up here, in the Tāmaki since 1990. So enough time to have seen mayors come and go. And Brown definitely is not afraid to have a crack at Wellington. But I would say in all of the time I've observed the Auckland Council, it's not really been a collection of geniuses. It's been a pretty poorly run city for a long time. And, some of the councillors there, you wouldn't let them wash your car, but screw that up type of thing. I think it's got better. It's got better. But, Jesus, there's a lot of chump meat in there. So, you know, sometimes trying to herd 19 councillors who are in there trying to look after their constituencies and stuff. So, you know, when you get right down to the nitty-gritty of how the money is spent, and I know Auckland's, you know, broken it up into Auckland Transport and Water Care and all that sort of the fiefdoms. But, you know, they have been just this massive bureaucracy. And I think that's what I like about Wayne Brown, you know, is he's trying to make it more efficient. But I think fixing Auckland's 30 years. It's going to take, you know, more. You know, I'm doing a bit of work in South Auckland at the moment. And tonight I came home at 6:45, so 6:45. The motorway was still blocked at Green Lane. And, you know, it took me the thick end of an hour to get home from down there, and that's just, you know, that's not peak hours. You know, 6:45 should be just a dream run. It's just rubbish like that where, you know, it's become quite a dysfunctional city. And the only way out of that is going to be big parks.
It has become a dysfunctional city because everything's gridlocked, and it's gridlocked often at 10 o'clock in the morning. So, you know, it just seems to be that you're lucky if you can get a clear run, but, you know, you need to factor in that if you're going anywhere, you can factor in an hour to an hour and a half for sure.
Yeah. And look, you know, the Auckland City is a collective of cities, you know, because I think what's the cutoff? You know, you have to have 20,000 population or something to be classified as a city. Mm. And so if you look at 1.7 million, and I look at Auckland City, and it's about 40 cities with no soul. You know, it's just like it's got no, because I live in Parnell, but I don't know anybody over in Rānui, and I go down to South Auckland, but it's these little silos that kind of don't cross over much to each other. So therefore, travelling from one, I suppose you'd call it a suburb rather than a city, to the next, let's say I go over to Remuera, then over to Epsom, and it's just all these little pockets that have grown from little towns into this big, well, it's a mess, actually. Going back to the days of Rodney Hyde, you know, when the concept of the super city was first proposed, I think when we look back at that, we're paying the price for some decisions really were made then.
Vaughan, I actually agree. I remember, I know Sir Barry Curtis personally, and Barry was the mayor of Manukau City. Now, you couldn't, and of course, which is at the whole of most of that South Auckland area, down to Frankton, I think. Now, you couldn't get a more passionate advocate for that whole area of Auckland.
And now
it's in the wash with every other community that's become part of the super city, and nobody in those communities now know what's going on. They don't even know who's representing them. They never get good feedback on some of their if they're putting in a submission or an initiative. It's just like goodness knows actually where the dollars are going to, and also how they're prioritizing the certain areas. So it seems to me, I don't know. I liked it when you had those areas.
And those passionate souls like the Barry Curtises, if they were around today, they would really struggle because, the wokeism would cut them off at every corner. There'd be stuff that they couldn't say and do, because they'd be in trouble. And that's the problem now, is the namby-pamby nature of local government. And I think that... And that sort of is to blame for a lot of the ineffectiveness that very little gets done in a 3-year local government term. And so that's why I'm trying to sort of have a soft spot for Wayne Brown, because I think he is trying to break down some barriers. But I think there's 11,000 staff in the Auckland Council. I mean, best of luck with that.
Yes, indeed.
You know,
indeed.
They have the ability to resist. It's like, you know, the bureaucracy can close down on the leadership if it wants to, and it does.
Oh.
It certainly happens in central government.
Yeah. Well, that's right. And that's also part of my fear with central government, because they've already been told by the national government, that, you know, there's significant job losses are going to occur in the public service. And recently, when I've been talking to some people in the public service, they're very nervous because, you know, they've been told and they don't know if it's going to be their department. Most of them do think that it'll be probably across the board. There'll be a directive given to the CEOs to slash 3% off the budget or God knows whatever. And if that happens, you know, staff will go, and then you've got all of these well-qualified public servants, most of them who live, many of them live, senior ones certainly, in Wellington and in other places around the country. And you know, to be told that your numbers, you know, you're going to be out the door. Well, you want to get people on your side when you're a new government. There's no doubt about that. I mean, by all means, look to see if there's expenditure that can be reined in. But I think just to tell people, jobs are going to go, and particularly at this time of the year also, they must be all worrying, can we afford to go on holiday? Can we afford to get grandmother over, Nana over from Australia?
Yeah, look, I'm aware of, inside a couple of the big departments with more than 3,000 staff, the restructuring had already been put in place, planning for a change in government. So there were, particularly at that upper leadership level, I think that a lot of CEOs who are smart enough to go, hey, I'm going to survive in my career regardless of who is in power, will be turning around and showing, look what good boy I've been doing and what I've done for the last 6 months. I've cut this much out. I'm aware of roles going in many areas in government. So it's already started. And because that's the thing about that restructure mentality. Once you get into it, you get very, very good at it. You kind of, you know, where you're just walking around with looking for savings everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very much a private sector mentality. But yeah, it's very infectious, restructures. And but then what happens with restructures is productivity goes out the window because people just go into defense mode. They're just looking to protect their butt. And so bugger all gets done.
Oh, that's true. That's true.